This is Hacker Public Radio episode 3403 for Wednesday, the 18th of August 2021. Today's show is entitled, Fourth on Microcontrollers. It is hosted by Brian in Ohio, and is about 22 minutes long, and carries a clean flag. The summary is, a little more about Fourth, and a couple of chapters, in the novel of my life.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by Archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
Hello, Hacker Public Radio. Brian in Ohio here. I'm out from under my rock. I'm sibleting and plosiving through another episode. This is part two of my dive into the fourth programming language. And I want to respond first to a nice comment from KG on my last show. And I would love to hear a show about your time at SAO. That's the place where Chuck Moore started working on fourth. It seemed maybe that was at Harvard, though, in Boston, not in Arizona. I'm not sure, but who knows? Maybe KG crossed paths with Chuck. As far as fourth's readability, I find that when looking at fourth code, somebody else's fourth code, that starting at the bottom of the listing and working your way up is the way to go. So an example of this would be I've made an alarm clock using a popular microcontroller board. And at the very bottom of the listing is a word, clock, that is defined as setup and operate clock. And then you work your way up to setup, and then setup is a procedure to initialize all the ports and variables. And an operated clock is a breakable endless loop. That sounds kind of doesn't make any sense, but I'll explain it when I get to that project in the future. And that endless loop pulls some of the keys and does some clock stuff. And then you can just work your way up through each word to try to understand what's going. And then the other thing you have to do when you're looking at fourth code is that you have to realize that unlike other languages, everything in a fourth listing is a word. There is no punctuation. There is syntax, but the syntax is this. A word is defined by some ASCII characters surrounded by spaces. And words are defined and put into the dictionary, and that's done by a symbol that we say is colon. You know, if you didn't know fourth, you'd see a colon. But that colon isn't just like punctuation. It's an actual fourth procedure. So there is no syntax sugar in fourth. And that's beautiful. And the reason I think it's beautiful is because it follows. When you program in C, the asterisks can mean different things in different contexts. But in fourth, it has only one definition in the dictionary that you're using. And that being said, an asterisk can mean different things in different, well, let's go back to the C. In C, an asterisk can mean multiplication. It could also mean a pointer. And then you get a bunch of asterisks together, and you got to figure out, is that a pointer to a pointer or a pointer? You know? So it becomes, I think, even more confusing than fourth in some ways, in the sense that you have to not only look at the symbol, you have to figure out from the context what the symbol means, which actually kind of makes compilers even more amazing in some ways. But in fourth, it's not that way. An asterisk means one thing, usually multiplication, and it takes two numbers off of the stack, and it multiplies them and puts the result back on the stack. And But you could redefine that if you wanted to. And that's the other thing that makes fourth hard to read, in that every fourth dictionary, every fourth system is unique. The old adage is, when you've seen one fourth, you've seen one fourth. And that means that because you're building definitions in fourth, there's probably no two fourth systems that are going to be exactly alike, because there are going to be words in that dictionary that are different than other words or not available in other systems. But you can always add words, and if you have something that you like and you're on a system that it's not there, you can probably define it for yourself. The only thing I will say about that is that, well, two things I'll say about that. This makes doing fourth standards difficult, because fourth, what does that mean? But I think that by fourth standards, they're like the fourth 2012 standard has a series of words that they consider the core system, and all fourth systems should have this. And then they have a bunch of different groups of words, core extensions and tools and things that exist that aren't necessarily required for a fourth system to be fourth 2012 compliant, but they're there and defined. And so as a minimum, when you find a word in fourth, let's use one a definite example here. So there's a word in fourth spelled D-U-P. It's pronounced dupe. It does the same thing on all fourth systems. It takes the first item on the stack and it copies it and puts that copy on top of the stack. So you end up with two copies of two of the same things on the top of the stack. And that dupe works the same on all systems. And there's generally, you know, a minimum, there's somewhere between, you know, there's probably 150 words that you need to make a minimal fourth system. And then you can build from there. So you'll always find the word dupe in a fourth system, but you may not find the word forget in all fourth systems. That's enough on that. Lastly, another thing you'll find as you start working in fourth is, because everything is a word, there things are named and you say things. So an example would be, when you see an exclamation point, you'll start saying in your mind, store, that exclamation point is a fourth word that takes the value on the top of the stack and stores it in the address that you've provided prior to that, the second item on the stack, and stores it into that register, or in that place in memory. It's kind of a pointer, or a pointer type function that in fourth. But what you'll find is you'll be reading a novel and you'll see an exclamation point, and you'll say store, and then you know you've fallen down the fourth rabbit hole. So my fall into that rabbit hole starts back in 1984. The Commodore 64 came out that year, and unfortunately, or fortunately as the case may be, unlike some people, I was a little bit too old to really get excited about that. I was just starting college, and college at that time still hadn't, there weren't a lot of computer, wasn't a lot of computer usage in college, even though I was a math major. We did some work on mainframes, but nobody had home computers for the most part. And basically I was into girls, cars, and airplanes, not necessarily in that order, but that was my life. And so I didn't really get into the early Commodore 64 craze of computing. I knew they were there and I played with computers a little bit, but it wasn't really a core part of what I was doing at the time. And so I kind of missed out on that part of the early home computer world. And by 1991, I had a family and I was in the military, and I finally got a Commodore 128. And that was the beginning of a lot of computer stuff for me. I subscribe to a disk magazine called Commodore. It was called Lodestar. I think I got every issue of Lodestar still, and they would come in little discs in the mail, and you would, and it had all kinds of cool programs on it that you could mess with. And also at that time, I basically started playing around on what was going to become the internet, you know, bulletin board systems and things like that. It was, so finally had the time, money, and energy to try out some of these things. It became very interesting, and that's when I kind of got into programming at that time. And then from about, I'd say from 95 to 2001, I was in the valley of the shadow of death. I was a Windows user. I didn't really know of anything else, but like most people who have switched to Linux, who started out as Windows users, I became more and more disappointed in the system. And then I'm pretty sure it was when they were going to try to make me pay for an upgrade to maybe to Vista or something like that. I said, forget it. And that's when I found out about Linux and started my move to the world of Linux. But that's maybe another episode for now. So about 2002, I found a book in the library about building a robot that was controlled by transistors. And I had always been sort of a little bit interested in electronics, and I thought that would be kind of a fun project to do with my son. And so we put together a little robot using transistors, and it worked okay. It was kind of a bump against the wall, change direction kind of thing. Very simple, but very cool. And that was sort of what got me into the maker movement. By 2005, maybe 2005, was when I think the first Make magazines came out. I was building stuff with electronics at that point, and the maker movement was really interesting to me. I went to some maker fairs and subscribed to the magazine and tried different things. Very cool. And it was probably at this time that I had already known that working with microcontrollers was very cool, and so I started working. I got a basic stamp. Basic stamp was a system on chip, I think we would call it now, with a basic interpreter. Never really did anything with the basic stamp. I think I bought it and never really used it. But then I bought a pickaxe. Pickaxe was a PIC microcontroller with a basic interpreter on. I think it was in the EEPROM. It was protected. And it was very Arduino-like. But it was in BASIC. You would buy, and I knew BASIC. You know, I think everybody by that point had learned some basic programming skills, so I played around with pickaxes, and they were kind of cool too. And I made some stuff, flashed some LEDs, and I don't think I made any big projects. And then Arduino came along, and I'm not going to go into a whole history of Arduino, but when the Arduino boards came out, those looked extremely. I saw that this is very cool. This is not only a board, it's a programming environment, and right at the beginning there was already a lot of cool open source resources out there that you could get projects moving and going using an Arduino. And so my first Arduino was actually the make it yourself single board Arduino. I think if you dig around their site, there's still boards, there's PDFs on how to make the board, and I etched my own boards and put it together and drilled out the 5,000 holes that were in that thing. It was fun. And then I bought an Arduino and just moved on from there. But there came a point there using Arduino that I realized there was limitations in certain things. Some of the interrupts didn't work. Registry access was weird. And it did obscure. There's some level of obscurity that sometimes you would find yourself doing something and you'd go, well, why did that fail? And then you realize the library that you had installed to make whatever hardware work wasn't very well written, and it just turns out that you're probably better off for some of these things just to write your own library And that's what I did. I think it was with the LCD module, the little character LCD modules that everybody uses. That was my first driver that I built. And it was kind of cool to see, oh, this is what's behind all that Arduino code. That's like one line of Arduino code is, you know, 100 lines of C code to get the your LCD up and running. So I began programming the Arduino boards in C, and you end up in that wonderful world of write, compile, test, debug. You know, you write some code, you compile it, you throw it on the board, you try it out, it fails, you try to figure out why it fails, and you go back, and it's just endless kind of cycle that can be, especially if you're compiling a pretty big source file, it can take a little while, and it's a little bit frustrating. But it was what it was, and I learned a lot in programming C, and I'm happy I did it. But along this time, I also started getting into Lisp through my use of Emacs, and so I learned some Lisp, and Lisp is a very cool language, and Forth, it at its root is a list processing language. It's a lot like Lisp in the sense that it looks through this list of definitions to try to figure out what to do next, and if it can't find it, it throws an error or it tries to make it a number or whatever. So anyway, along comes I found, you know, just as you're searching around, a guy, and I will put the link in the show notes for his site, because it's still a live project and it's very cool. It's MicroLisp. MicroLisp is Lisp on an AVR microcontroller. And so when I saw this, I was like, this is very, very cool, because you're not doing this write, compile, test, debug cycle. You're working at the repel, and you can type stuff in and see it work. And then if you like it, you can save it and store it and then recall it. And MicroLisp is pretty cool, but it has its limitations. It doesn't really give you a lot of coding space on the Arduino controller, because its size is pretty big. And he's sort of tied himself to the Arduino environment for its uploading the base stuff. Anyway, it's a cool project, but I saw its limitations, and it was something I just kind of tinkered with. And then during this time, I started watching some YouTube videos by Ben Eater, Eater.net, I think is his thing. I'll put links again in the show note for this. He is a guy who built one of these no CPU computers on a breadboard, and then he's also got some videos on building a 6502 based computer on breadboards now. His videos are really worth watching. Very well done. He's got a really great way of explaining stuff that's pretty complicated, and yet he does it in a way that you can really understand. But that 6502 is, of course, the core of the Commodore computers, and so that, of course, was my early computer life, the, you know, 6502 based. And so I thought, oh, that'd be kind of cool to do a 6502 single board kind of computer home built thing. So I found a site, 6502.org, I think it is, and there's all kinds of projects on that site. And it was there that I discovered Forth. And one of the things, it was Forth on a 6502, and I started reading about it, and I did some more looking around, and lo and behold, there's Forth. There were Forths available for AVR microcontrollers. So that's when I discovered the first one, which is eForth, which is classic. There's books, I'll put some links again. There's books on that show the complete source code for Forth, eForth, and it was developed by a man called Chen Hansen Ting. The book that's classic is the Arduino and eForth, Very cool book. Really describes forth at its roots, and is even if you never put eForth on an Arduino or anything, if you're into forth, that's a good book to look at. Then I just found another project called AmForth. It's very robust. It's been around for years, and it is forth for AVR microcontrollers and some other boards, and it's pretty full featured. And then I found the forth that I'm using now, which is FlashForth. I like FlashForth a little better than AmForth because of its the way it's unified the memory. The system doesn't use the EEPROM for any part of its actual core system. It has some words built in, one of them being marker that you have to add to AmForth anyway, but it's already built in. And there's some other convenience kind of things that are built into FlashForth specifically for the AVR that make it AVR microcontroller that make it easy to use when you're using Forth on an AVR microcontroller. I think I will stop there. That's how I got into Forth. Oh, I might add, there is of course MicroPython out there, but I try to avoid using Python. I don't really like it. So anyway, but maybe you'll love MicroPython. But that's another one where you can, I guess, do stuff right at sort of a rappel, a command line, and get things to work. But I've settled on Forth for my interactions with the microcontrollers, and so I'll stop there. On the next show, I think I'll talk about putting Forth on an AVR microcontroller board. Maybe I'll try to show a few different ones, how to get them installed, and maybe my little bit of a review of them. And then after that, I guess this is going to expand to more than three shows, and then I'll talk about doing that Hello World program. But for now, it's Brian in Ohio here. Thanks for listening. If you have any comments, leave a comment. Make a show yourself about MicroPython or anything that sounds cool, hackery. One last thing. I wanted to talk about that guy on the internet. The last show that I listened to where he's talking about working at the command line, very good episode. He is a guy who, although when I sometimes make comments about apt-get and stuff, he's not that guy. He is a guy who's digging, learning, and I didn't even realize he could do all that stuff with apt-get and stuff and searching and a very, very good episode. And so when I make fun of people using apt-get as their solution to a programming problem, it's not a person like that guy on the internet. I'm talking about a person who stops at apt-get and doesn't dig any farther, who just is happy with the, you know, just some blind incantation and who knows what ends up on your system. So anyway, enough of that. Till the next show, Brian in Ohio signing off. And I'd like to say that a life without risk is a life not worth living. Take care.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.